From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Hello and welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Kim Lewis, and joining me on the panel this week are VOA Congressional Correspondent Catherine Gibson and VOA White House Bureau Chief Patsy Whitaker-Zwara. Welcome, Catherine and Patsy. Well, here are the issues. President Biden intimated that his Russian counterpart could face personal sanctions should Moscow give a green light for its army to invade Ukraine. The Biden administration is sending weapons to the government in Kiev and pulling Americans out of the country. Democrats are readjusting their strategy as they head toward midterm elections in November by trying to figure out a path forward on a pared-down social and climate spending bill without boxing themselves in with a hard deadline. The Biden administration is formally withdrawing its vaccine and testing mandate for businesses after the Supreme Court blocked the requirements earlier this month. Liberal Justice Stephen Breyer, at 83, the oldest member of the U.S. Supreme Court, will retire at the end of the court's current term that runs until the end of June, giving President Biden the opportunity to appoint a successor who could serve for decades.
Well, those are the issues, and let's get started. Well, Patsy, senior White House officials told reporters that we are prepared to implement sanctions with massive consequences that were not considered in 2014 when Russia annexed Crimea. Analysts say these are some of the strongest sanctions they have seen. The Kremlin has said any personal sanctions on Putin would be politically destructive. So what severe sanctions could be placed on Russia, and is it enough to stop Putin from reinvading Ukraine?
Yeah, well, that's a big question, right? And every time I talk to analysts, there's always a difference in terms of just how bad these sanctions could hit Russia and could hit Putin, both in his own personal sphere as well as politically. Certainly, the White House's line is that this has never been done before. This is much stronger than it was in 2014. But the problem is, of course, that sanctions on Russia may trigger Vladimir Putin's government to react back, to retaliate. And the ones who will be hurting the most from Russia's retaliation would be the Europeans, particularly in its energy sector. We know that about 40% of gas that's supplied for Europe, and right now Europe is in the winter months and they very much need Russian gas. 40% of European gas is from Russia. So that is certainly something that the White House is considering in order to shore up alliances with Europe to make sure that NATO allies are all on the same page in terms of harsh sanctions against Russia, in terms of harsh response towards Russian aggression towards Ukraine. And that's one thing that they're trying to do, is try to shore up energy supplies from other parts of the world so that should Russia retaliate against these harsh sanctions and cut off gas supplies and other energy supplies to Europe, then there is something to fall back on. But of course, obviously, this is not something that can be done quickly or easily, and it will still cause pain to a lot of European populations. And this may be the one thing that the Biden administration can't control. You know, I mean, the European politicians need the support of their people in order to enact harsh sanctions and their harsh rhetoric against Russia. It really remains to be seen. And the biggest, weakest link here is Germany.
Yes, and also in looking at the Biden administration sending weapons into Ukraine and pulling Americans out of the country, as well as considering a possible move to put 8,500 troops on alert for possible deployment to Eastern Europe. So, Catherine, what is Congress saying about these moves?
Well, it's interesting if you drill down into the different Republican and Democratic sanctions bills. Of course, on Capitol Hill, there's always a political element to all of this. There's a back and forth with some congressional Republicans, most actually, saying that Biden has really not been tough enough in the way that they say President Trump was against Russia, which, you know, there's a lot of Democrats who would push back against that assertion that President Trump was tough on Russia. What they're saying is that Biden isn't ready to go immediately with sanctions. They wanted to see that bill from Republican Senator Ted Cruz sanctioning the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which is a key Russian project. They wanted to get that going immediately. Well, Democrats say that they can have that in their back pocket to implement if indeed Putin invades Ukraine. But when you really look at the two bills that are out there still, there's still a lot of military aid for Ukraine, designating Russia as a state sponsor of terrorism, sending in aid, very, very similar when you drill down into those details, and an agreement that Putin and his cronies will be sanctioned severely. It's just a matter of, is it before the invasion or is it after the invasion? So as always on Capitol Hill, a lot of political back and forth, and Republicans using this as an opportunity in the wake of that U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, which many called disastrous, to use this as another example and saying that President Biden's foreign policy has been weak, ineffective, and has damaged the U.S. standing on the global stage.
If I may just add on Catherine's point, the fact that President Biden is seen as weak by Republicans, that's certainly something that the White House is very much aware of, and that is included in their political calculation, right? I mean, at this point, the American population, there's absolutely no appetite for war, considering the fact that, you know, we are all still under the pandemic, still trying to recover economically, high inflation and so on. So the administration is very much aware that conflict with Russia over Ukraine is really the last thing that they want, particularly because other adversaries are also watching, including China, which may become emboldened to take over Taiwan should this happen. So this is a very, very critical foreign policy crisis for the Biden administration, and they're very concerned that there's going to be missteps, miscalculations. And as we can see from the response that was delivered to the Russians, the formal diplomatic U.S. response, those principles are enshrined in the response, in the sense that, number one, we want to manage this conflict. We want to continue to offer a diplomatic path out of this crisis.
Right. And it's interesting for the international audience listening to understand that the ways these foreign policy debates get shaped domestically here in the United States implies that the U.S. president kind of has this broad power to impact global crises, when really war, direct war with Russia, is simply not on the table. The option that's on the table is arming Ukrainian army, arming them and letting them fight the war against Russia. So really, like, there's an understanding deeply on Capitol Hill that these are the options available to Biden, but the domestic political debate requires Republicans to criticize Biden and use this opportunity to make their case against the other party. So it's a little bit of how the back and forth goes in this country, particularly when we have these foreign policy crises.
And the lessons from Afghanistan, which is fresh in everybody's mind.
Absolutely.
Yes, and also going back to something you mentioned earlier, Patsy, with the energy aspect of this, analysts have pointed out that Putin had already gained some victories at home from this crisis over Ukraine, with higher oil and gas prices as a boon to energy exporter Russia. And the world is talking about him. Really, what is his goal then? No one wants to really go to war. Does Putin?
Right. And that's a question that I ask many analysts, and most of them say he cannot afford a war either. And what will he do if he invades Ukraine, a country of 40 million people? Many of them want to turn towards the West more than Russia. I mean, depending on where you are, I suppose. What is he going to do with that? So for many of the analysts that I spoke to, some have underlined the fact that Vladimir Putin, what he wants the most is attention, is respect, is to be considered as one of the big players in the world. And so some analysts have tied this to the fact that with the U.S. focusing so much attention on China and giving so much oxygen to Xi Jinping and what he does and the rise of China and so on, there's a certain desire for Putin perhaps to be able to be considered in that sphere as well. And essentially he's saying, hey, look at me, I can still create trouble for you as well. And so I deserve the respect that I get for being the leader of a large, and, you know, some may argue that a country that wants to go back to its former past glory.
Right. There's a certain element where now he's back a part of the global conversation, and he's back having this discussion that he's always brought up, that he believes that the breakup of the Soviet Union in the 1990s was the greatest tragedy of the 20th century. And now he's bringing everyone back to that discussion and reminding people that Russia has these claims, unfounded or not, on all of these Eastern European countries, and he's bringing that back up to keep that in the running for a global discussion.
Yes, and we will continue to monitor developments on the Russia-Ukraine situation. But on Capitol Hill, Democrats are looking at a scaled-back agenda after major setbacks. The number two Democrat Senator Dick Durbin said, quote, "We have to have an agenda that is not only appealing to voters, but is realistic on Capitol Hill," unquote. He also added that it was okay to have an ambitious agenda, but it has to come to the harsh reality of producing votes. So, Catherine, how are Democrats readjusting their strategy to prepare for upcoming midterm elections?
Yeah, no, I think that Durbin quote really sums it up. You have kind of the ambitious first year agenda where you're a new president, a new administration, a new democratically controlled Congress. That was the first year where you try and, you know, you take some big swings for these big legislative items. Now we're in 2022. Now we're in a midterm election year, even though it's still 10 months, 11 months away. Legislators are already thinking about how they're going to sell all of their achievements or lack of achievements back home in their home districts. So now this is really where you get down to the nitty-gritty and you start trying to make some deals so that you can pass maybe not so ambitious legislation, but at least get something passed. And what's really hard up on Capitol Hill is that there's this old adage that Congress has a really hard time walking and so-called chewing gum at the same time. There are only so many things that it can do at once, and there's a lot to get done. We have government funding that needs to be passed by mid-February. We have the social spending and climate change spending package, so-called Build Back Better, which has repeatedly failed and now needs to be scaled down so that at least it can pass in some form. And Democrats are still looking at that voting rights legislation and electoral college reform. You know, Democratic leadership in the House was telling reporters this week that they think there's still possibly a way to get some of that through if they can do a scaled down bill. So this is really where you come down to the details and see what legislators, Democrats and Republicans, can actually compromise on. And that's going to be hard when everybody wants to tout their party and their party's achievements going into the midterm elections.
And that's certainly a sense that President Biden is also understanding, is that he does now realize that he needs to scale back his ambition. You know, he basically conceded last week to breaking up his signature Build Back Better package that Catherine has mentioned. This is the huge $1.9 trillion social spending plan and climate change plan. And he basically said last week that I know that this is not going to pass the way I want it to pass in that form. So he's agreed to breaking it up, acknowledging that some proposals won't survive, and also signaling his openness to exploring what this pared down bill might look like. But it doesn't mean that he stopped trying. He met with corporate executives from major companies about this proposal, arguing the benefits of it for childcare, for the climate, for other provisions of the economy. So as Catherine mentioned, the window is closing with midterm elections coming up. There's not many more months before the Biden administration can get the legislative agenda passed. And should the midterm election happen and the Democratic control of the House and Senate, you know, become even less so, then that spells trouble for President Joe Biden.
And also with there still being division within the party, how is this going to affect the midterm elections? Or is this just a normal part of a political party to have these divisions?
Democrats always argued that their party is a big umbrella party. And what that means is that they argue that they're more accepting of a range of viewpoints and a range of healthy debate on the issues. We know, of course, that there's the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, Senator Bernie Sanders, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, these people who want to push more of a progressive agenda in terms of government spending. Well, the centrists, Democrats, some of whom may be in districts that were once won by former President Trump, don't want to go that far and want to pursue a more middle of the road agenda. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi always argues that that is a healthy tension within the Democratic Party. But of course, as we know, two Democratic senators in the U.S. Senate, Manchin and Sinema, have really held up that agenda. They're arguing that they want to see more compromise in the U.S. Senate instead of blowing up the Senate rules. The really big question, though, is, are we past the point of compromise in this partisan political environment? Can that even get done anymore? particularly in a midterm election year. So that's going to be really interesting to see how those two react in the coming months and how all of that plays out.
Yeah, but also just to remind everyone that this is not a new dynamic. I mean, this exact same dynamic also happened under Republican Congress. Remember the Tea Party and the moderate wing of the Republicans at that time? We still had some of those moderate wing Republicans, and they faced the same kind of bogged down dynamic when it was their turn a couple of years ago. So this is something that's becoming very common in American politics, this partisan gridlock, both between the two parties and within the parties themselves, sadly.
Yes, and when Biden takes parts of his sweeping social and climate spending bill out on the campaign trail, we'll have to monitor public reaction to it as well. Well, it's time now for a quick break, and when we return, the Biden administration withdraws its COVID-19 vaccine mandate after a Supreme Court decision. Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype, VOA White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wittakuswara, and VOA Congressional Correspondent Katherine Gibson. Well, Patsy, the Biden administration is formally withdrawing its vaccine and testing mandate for businesses after the Supreme Court blocked the requirements earlier this month. Is the White House ending its legal battle over this, or will it try to get the decision overturned?
No, the Biden administration is ending its legal battle over the mandate, at least for now. OSHA will ask the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit to dismiss all cases related to the mandate. This is according to the Labor Department. And essentially what the Biden administration is doing right now is just calling on businesses to voluntarily implement these requirements, these vaccine mandates. And you can see that many businesses have done this. Many businesses believe that in order to keep their employees and also their customers safe, everybody needs to get vaccinated. So this is something that the Biden administration realized that this is not a legal battle that they have won, particularly in the Supreme Court, where six of the nine justices lean conservative. We'll just see whether or not the companies will continue to ask their employees to be vaccinated. And in the meantime, the Biden administration is also ramping up other means of protecting the American population from the COVID pandemic, particularly Omicron, both with providing free testing kits as well as masks, which many people argue, of course, that is too little, too late.
Katherine, the court wrote that although Congress has indisputably given OSHA the power to regulate occupational dangers, it has not given that agency the power to regulate public health more broadly. So it looks like the court was concerned with the scope of the mandate more so than how it was issued. So what is Congress' reaction to the decision?
That's right. There was a sense that this was the expected outcome given the scope of that decision. And up on Capitol Hill, Democrats are kind of pivoting and saying, you know, look, even though this mandate has ended, as Patsy mentioned, the administration is working in other ways to try and mitigate the effects of this pandemic. The masks, the testing should be wider spread. We saw a lot of trouble during the holiday season. Americans could not get rapid testing for COVID. There were long lines. Some of the places were even sold out. But legislators are working to make sure that this isn't as much of an issue anymore, and arguing that once we have widespread testing in this country, once people have access to masks, people are getting used to the idea that COVID is going to be around. We're seeing Omicron come down in some parts of the country, especially as we head into the warmer spring months, that there is a sense that now we all have an idea of how to live with COVID, and there are certain elements that are being addressed to get this pandemic under control. Of course, as Patsy said, we're 2 years into the pandemic, and a lot of this is too little, too late. And there's still a lot of debate in this country over the impact the pandemic has had on the American economy, on inflation and supply chains. And that, of course, will also be an element going into the 2022 midterms and how lawmakers make the argument that they've addressed the impact of this pandemic.
And I think one of the bigger criticism leveled against the Biden administration is that they really over-relied on vaccinations. So they put all their eggs in the vaccination basket. They, you know, did not put enough resources into making sure that people can get tested. And this may be something strange for our listeners who may be very used to being able to get free testing from the government or being, you know, used to just getting tested in workplaces or schools or whatever. In the United States, it's actually just now ramping up. Testing is just now ramping up. Before that, you know, you had to wait in long lines to get tested. Now you can go to a government website and order tests. So this is certainly something that the Biden administration has been criticized for, the fact that they thought that just by focusing on vaccinations, we are going to get out of this pandemic. They, I think, undercalculated the fact that there are still many Americans who are hesitant to be vaccinated. There's a lot of people against the vaccines, and particularly Omicron, where you can still get sick even though you are boosted. So this is certainly something that they will need to look at and consider as part of their pandemic strategy going forward.
You both have brought up some really good points on this, but we want to get our last topic in.
Liberal Justice Stephen Breyer, at 83, the oldest member of the U.S. Supreme Court, will retire at the end of the court's current term that runs until the end of June.
This development comes amid a blockbuster term, which could see the justices rein in federal abortion rights enshrined in Roe versus Wade and expand the Second Amendment. What does this retirement mean for Democrats?
As you mentioned, Kim, there's still going to be a conservative majority on the U.S. Supreme Court. The nomination of Amy Coney Barrett during the last few months of President Trump's term in office cemented that. She's one of those key votes on the court. But this does help get newer, fresher, progressive, possibly faces onto the U.S. Supreme Court. One of President Biden's key campaign promises was that he would nominate a Black female jurist if that spot opened up on the court. And there are a number of options already being floated out there. All of these options are Black women in their 50s, which means that they could potentially be serving on the court for the next three decades.
Yeah, we also have to remember that with Democrats holding a very narrow majority in the Senate, President Biden will have to choose somebody that all 50 Democrats will have to support, and then have Vice President Kamala Harris be the tie-breaking vote. Now, obviously, by saying on the campaign trail, pledging that he will choose a Black woman, that gives him even less of options that can be supported by all 50 and maybe even get a handful of Republican votes. And there's a lot of pressure to get this right because, as Catherine said, this is his opportunity to install somebody in this highest court of the land to ensure that even though it's not going to change the balance of the court, it will still be 6 conservatives and 3 liberal justices, but he will certainly choose somebody who is much younger than Justice Breyer. And, you know, obviously this is because in the American system, Supreme Court justices serve for life.
Adding to what Patsy said, a really important point about whether or not Biden will even get those Republican votes. The last two Supreme Court confirmations that I've covered for Justice Brett Kavanaugh and Justice Amy Coney Barrett have turned into very divisive partisan battles over the future of the Supreme Court, when that actually historically used to be an area where you could get some across the aisle participation and cooperation. There used to be this idea that the Supreme Court should not be politicized and the confirmation process in particular should not be. That certainly has gone completely out the window in the past two confirmations with Kavanaugh and Amy Coney Barrett. And I expect that that will be the case this time around, particularly because, as Patsy mentioned, we are headed into a midterm election year, and we know that that Supreme Court confirmation can really mobilize voters on both sides of the aisle, of both political persuasions. That really gets people motivated to go out to the ballot box and vote, according to how that all went down.
Excellent points you all have brought up on this topic, and we'll have to end the show on that note as we are out of time. My thanks go to our panelists, VOA White House Bureau Chief Patsy Whitaker-Zwara and VOA Congressional Correspondent Catherine Gibson. I'm Kim Lewis, and thanks for joining us for Issues in the News.